When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Listening to the House of Indie.
Hey, welcome to another episode of the House of Indie. My name is Joey Galvez, and I'm here with another great creator. This time we have Richard Davis in the studio. Rich, how's it going, man?
Hey, what's up, Joey?
We haven't been formally introduced, but we've been friends online like everybody else these last few years.
Yeah.
But man, how's it even going?
That's going great, man. You know, we finally got some warm weather here in Tennessee. Yeah. I'm super happy with that. I'm so over winter.
Oh man, I'm out in Arizona, so bring me some of the winter weather.
You can have it all. Well, I went to Phoenix last year, uh-huh. And man, I swear, I can move there. I love the weather.
I say we swap houses, man, because I'm all about that.
Hey, you know what? You see what you say when it's August and the humidity's like 75%.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. And then you tell me if you want to live here. But like, I swear, man, 110 degrees in Phoenix felt like 65 and awesome here. So, I mean, I was in heaven, man.
100%
right. Humidity, yes.
Yeah, I know it's bad. It is. I went to Florida in the summertime. Well, it was like in that transitional time. You know, that's when it's the roughest times, right? So oh, yeah. So I went out there and I've got really bad asthma. Oh man, it was so thick and so rough. I couldn't. So I'm good where I'm at.
Yeah, you're like, I'll go visit the South.
There
you know?
There you go.
I mean, there's a lot of great things about the South, but humidity ain't one of them.
I bet. Let's talk a little bit about your work, man, because you've been working with Source Point Press on Cult of Dracula. And I was introduced to this not through Source Point Press, not through knowing a little bit about you, but through my buddy Dave Lentz. He worked with you guys a little bit on that.
Dave's my letterer, man. He's fantastic.
Yeah, so he's a really good buddy of mine, and he helped me out with some of the logo work for some of my podcasts and good stuff like that. But man, and he was telling me about this stuff, and I was talking to him. He's like, man, I got something going on right now. I can't talk to you about it, but you're gonna love it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. Yes, give me more. So let's talk a little bit about Cult of Dracula.
Yeah. So Cult of Dracula was my first comic, 6 issues long. The trade paperback's out now. You can get it in comic book stores all over the country, and it's in Target. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. So pick it up. It's a modern reimagining of Stoker's original story set within a Manson family-inspired cult.
Yeah. Yeah, then, and it's absolutely amazing, fantastically gruesome. You guys are if you guys love this stuff, you're going to be all about it.
It is. Some people have called it gore porn, and I totally agree with that. You know, I'm a horror guy. I'm a huge horror fan. If I have my choice between 15 different genres of movie, I'm going to gravitate to horror every single time. And you know, I grew up loving those, those late 70s, early 80s slasher films. You know, Tom Savini is a god, in my opinion. And, later on, Eli Roth and the Splat Pack, you know, I love the stuff they do. Cult of Dracula and now Rise of Dracula, which is my new book. It's out in stores now. Issue 2 just came out. It's kind of a love letter to horror fans written by a horror fan. We blend several different genres of horror into Cult and Rise. Cult is more of a Southern Gothic horror, Toby Hooper, Texas Chainsaw Massacre style. And Rise is more of a dystopian near future, kind of John Carpenter inspired. And then when we get to Reign of Dracula, which is volume three, it's full on George Miller post-apocalyptic. The world is just fucked.
that's awesome, man. So how much of where you live, where you set up shop, how much of that is inspired in your books, man?
All of it. You know, I am a very proud Tennessean. Rocky Top will always be home sweet home to me. And I do everything I can to work in that culture that we have here. You know, I had a professor in college when I was young and cocky and, you know, thought I knew everything in the world. And he used the line, you know, write what you know. And I completely misinterpreted that as a 17, 18 year old kid in college. And I thought, well, so what? I can't tell stories unless, you know, I can't write a vampire story because I'm not a vampire. And now that I'm older, you know, I look back and I realize, oh, okay, I get it now. And I was dumb as a brick for not getting it back then. You know, your life, your upbringing, your experience, when you write from that, it comes off as more believable because you're more confident with it. You have a deeper understanding of it. And so, yeah, I tried to work, like in Cult of Dracula, the church that we begin with. I mean, I drove by that same church a million different times, going down a million different country roads. The people, the way they approach things, the culture, how deeply seated religion is into the culture. You know, that's how I grew up, man. You know, and I kind of forgot that when I moved away. I moved to the beach and, it was a little more liberal, a little more laid back. People went to church, but when they were done, they came home, they had dinner and watched football, you know, but here in the deep South, you know, it's like you go to church on Sunday morning, you go to church on Sunday evening, and you're back on Wednesday, and then you're doing like, I mean, you're defined by where you go to church. And, it's such a pervasive part of your life here in the South. So, you know, I wanted to kind of include that into Cult of Dracula as well. So you get to look at that cult mentality and kind of the perversion of that, that religious fervor, you know, kind of the dark side of it. So it was really fun to write. And it, you know, I throw in a reference to Tennessee any way that I possibly can. I mean, like, you'll see there's a scene where Mina is wearing a University of Tennessee sweatshirt while she's studying, you know. So little things like that, and then big things like we set an entire scene on Copperhead Road, which is the bootlegging road between Johnson City and Knoxville, Tennessee. Well, part of it's Copperhead Road, other part's Thunder Road.
Yeah, you got to put those little bits in there. And man, it's so cool because you feel like when you are creating something, you have to put a little bit a piece of your home in it. And what an amazing backdrop. Listen, I've never been to Tennessee, but I've, you know, through osmosis, we know a little bit about the South, right? And it's gorgeous, right? There's such a gorgeous mm-hmm. thing, but there's always the other side of gorgeous. And that's the mystery. And that's the one thing. And I love that you have this backdrop and you're embracing that mystery of that backside of gorgeous.
It's like, you know, there's I think one of the blurbs that we put in previews was, you know, in the South, everyone knows there are certain roads you don't go down.
Oh, yeah.
Both literally and figuratively. And that's true. There are places, you know, backwoods way back in the sticks in here in East Tennessee that I wouldn't go down those roads. There's no way. And there's some old coal mining roads, and oh man, it's scary back there.
That's awesome, man. And what amazing thing. So let's talk a little bit about how you got into comic books, man, because I know a little bit about how you own a shop, right?
Mm-hmm. So, I do. Yeah. I own a shop in Knoxville called Nirvana Comics. And, I've taken a kind of a long and winding road to get here. I've worked for newspapers. I worked in radio. Mm-hmm. I worked film. I owned a theater for many years. Worked for two presidential campaigns.
Wow.
I own a comic book store. And you know, I finally finally took the leap and wrote a comic. And thankfully, it did pretty well. So I think they're going to let me keep doing it for a while.
Yeah, man, something right is happening.
Yeah, man. Blown away, yeah.
So let's talk about, so there's a difference to the different face to comic books now, right? But 2-3 years ago, comic shops were different. They were not striving as much. We made a shift, and now everybody's doing different. We have online, we have whatnot sales, we have all kinds of these different things. You have so many different avenues, so much more. And then the more you get out there and promote yourself and market your work, it just blows up all the other aspects of your life. So I completely understand what it. Comic shops, as long as you are putting in the work and putting in the hustle, you're going to strive.
Yeah. And you have to, you're right. The comic book shop, it's changed. Like when I was a kid, you know, a comic book shop could be like a dingy little basement store in a strip mall with, you know, just wall to wall long boxes. And, you know, those stores, they're dinosaurs now, man. They're gone. They're dying. And, you know, you have to have a business acumen to run a comic book store, and you have to be able to separate your fandom from your business. Like I was having a conversation, Teenie Howard, who's writing Catwoman for DC right now. She actually used to work for me at my store, and she and I had a long conversation. Teenie is one of those people who just wants to know everything about the industry and wants to learn possible things she can. So we were talking about, you know, how I put in orders. This is many years ago. And, you know, I had to explain to her that, you know, sometimes the books that you think are cool aren't going to be the books that are profitable. And, you know, it took her a long time to understand that. But once she did, she was like, oh, I get it now. You know, so a lot of the stores, unfortunately, that are suffering right now are the ones that are owned by people who are just hardcore fanboys. And they have the love and the passion for comics, but they don't understand how to make money off of.
Yeah, and, I think that's perfect. You have to, I love that. You have to have the skin, I guess, to be in that game, right?
Yep. Because if you don't have the business acumen, there's nothing wrong with just being a badass super collector. You know, you can have your whole house filled with wall to wall comics, but don't lose your life savings because you think you can open up a comic book store and you have no business training. I mean, go to business school, go to community college at minimum. Get yourself learn how business works before you take the leap. There's no reason you can't open your own business, but if you just jump into it and think, oh, I love comics, so that means I can make money off of it, you're going to find yourself in a lot of trouble. That was the one rule my wife Amber and I had we had two rules. One was when we decided to open a shop, she said, if we open a comic book store, we got to do it differently. You know, because I had a great experience growing up in comic book stores. I mean, I'm a straight white male. I was always welcome at every comic book store I ever went to. My wife, Amber, who actually knew more about comics than I did, she had a totally different experience. You know, being a woman, she was always, you know, either not welcomed or kind of looked at or ogled, you know. And so she said, if we're going to open up a comic book store, we've got to do it differently. We've got to make it accessible and welcoming to women and everybody. And that's where the industry is going now. But the second rule that we had was, if we're going to open up a comic book store, every book that comes through in every collection, it's for sale. We don't take anything home. You know, we're not putting anything in our personal collection. It goes to the shop. We sell it. Because if you don't have that discipline and that rule, what's going to happen is you're going to keep all the cool stuff for yourself, and your store hasn't got anything to sell, and nobody's going to come see you.
There you go. You can always have your personal collection. Yeah, that is the one thing that I know. I have a handful of friends.
Never get high on your own supply.
There you go.
Scarface, man.
I wasn't going to go there. I was not going to go there. But yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Don't get high on your own supply. Listen, I got a handful of friends who are comic shop owners, and that's exactly the same thing they say. They say, listen, everything that comes through that door, whether it's a 181 or whatever it is, it's going to get sold. I want it in my freaking collection. Every geek out there wants that in their collection, right? They will freaking move mountains to get it. But you got to flip it if it's in your shop.
My whole life, I wanted a Fantastic Four or Five. I wanted that first Doctor Doom. And for whatever reason, every show I went to, that book always eluded me. I couldn't find it. And then one day a dude brought it into my shop. He had a big Fantastic Four collection. That one was in there. It was TGC grade. It's like a 4.0. And I bought it and I called Amber up and I was like, I am so tempted to break our rule right now. I really want this book. And Amber was a hard ass. I mean, she was like, we can't do that. And I, you know, I kept on and I pouted and I, you know, I kind of threw a little tantrum about it. And she said, okay, put it on the shelf for a week, put it in the case for a week. If it doesn't sell, you can take it home. And, you know, we were both thinking, you know, it's this expensive book. It's not going to sell in a week, you know? And I was like, all right, I'm excited. I made that deal with her. I put it out and I swear, hand to God, I put it out in my case. 20 minutes later, a guy walks through the door, says, is that a first Dr. Doom? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, what do you want for it? I'm like, so I threw my crazy price out. Like, you know, it was like GPA plus like 20%.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to sell it. I'd be damned if he didn't buy that book. So I owned it for 20 minutes and then it was gone.
That's hilarious. And you got your insane price.
I did. There was no way this guy was going to pay that.
Oh, my gosh.
I overpriced it on purpose so badly. There's no way he's going to buy it. And he just whipped out the Amex and took it home. And I'm like, shit. I've never owned another one.
Well, somebody that day must have paid their credit card bill. <'Cause> Right? He's like, yes, I paid it off. Now it's time to get something else.
He's like, boom.
you asked me on the wrong day, buddy.
Yep.
All right, man. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about your creative process. All right, we are back from the break and I'm still here with Richard Davis. I'm going to call you Sir Richard Davis. I don't know why. It just feels right.
I've been called better. I've been called worse.
So, Rich, let's talk a little bit about your creative process here. I know you're a jack of all trades. You've had almost all kinds of crazy cool jobs in the day. But man, I want to know what it takes when it comes to Richard Davis putting the pen to the paper.
Yeah. So, I'm what you call a gardener. There's a school of thought where there are essentially two types of writers. There's architects and there's gardeners. Architects are the type of people who lay out very detailed, very specific A to B to C plot lines, and then they fill their characters in to progress through those. Gardeners are more character driven. You know, where do the characters want to go? Where do the characters want to take this story? So that's more my style. Like I write a very basic outline for how I want an issue to go. You know, and I want, you know, you follow the same, you know, the 5-point arc and all that. You know, that's been around since the Greeks, and it works. So, you know, you write that basic outline. But then sometimes, you know, one of my characters is like taps me on the shoulder and says, hey, I want to go over here. Let's do this for a minute. You know I'm supposed to get here, but I want to go here. So, you know, I have conversations with my characters. Like I sit there in my office as I'm writing and I'm like, you know, I'm saying their dialogue out loud and I'm answering it. So, you know, I think I draw a lot from my theater background because, you know, that's a common practice. You know, in rehearsal. So I think that having a theatrical and a film background, I think helps me to create my characters. You know, the books have been widely praised for the depth of character and the quippiness of the dialogue. And I'm very proud of that. You know, and I'm very happy that readers have enjoyed it that way. So, you know, I think that aspect of my background really, really helps me in that. Sometimes my plots meander and there are some subplots that kind of fizzle out. You know, that's one of the downfalls to being a gardener. But, you know, the flip side is sometimes the architect, you know, they have their endings always deliver because everything's been building to this crescendo. But sometimes their characters feel kind of stilted and you're like, I don't think that character would have done that. You know, you know, there's pluses and minus, pros and cons to being a gardener or an architect. I just tend to lean more toward the gardener side.
So that means that you don't do too much of like writing extensive character Bibles on each and every one of your characters in the books then, right?
No, man, because I do an obscene amount of research about the world I'm building and the concepts. Like, as far as, like, I spent, no kidding, you know, close to 100 hours listening to interviews with Charles Manson. Oh, wow. Because I wanted Renfield to have that Manson vibe, mm-hmm. and that rhythm. Manson had a music to the way he spoke, and he wanted to be a musician. So it came through in the way when he talked to people. And, you know, I studied dozens and dozens of serial killers and cult leaders. And, you know, I'm definitely on an FBI watch list now. I researched vampire mythology from all over the world and folklore. I mean, you know, I really was impressed by Philippine vampire mythology with the Aswang and the Mandrugo. How it's different from the Western idea of the vampire. So I wanted all of that to inform the world I was building. But as far as the characters go, they kind of introduced themselves to me as I wrote the story. I mean, I knew who they were. I knew who they were at this point in time when they were walking into this book. But, you know, they told me who they were and what their backstory was as the story went along. And I know that sounds insane to anybody who doesn't write. And it probably sounds insane to a lot of people who do write. But, that's just what works for me. You know, I treat my characters like they're real people. And, you know, we have conversations. We get to know each other.
So have you always done it this way? Or was there always was there a way that didn't work that you had to kind of sift through to get to this point of being comfortable?
Yeah, I, going through school, creative writing classes, theater classes, things like that, they teach you the different methods. And so sometimes you have to adhere to those, you know, like the professor will tell you, you have to write it this way. And, you know, they wanted those, you know, those architect detailed plot lines and outline, things like that. And I tried it. It doesn't really work for me because it always feels very forced. I don't know. It just doesn't work well for me, you know, because I get, even if I write a very detailed outline, I don't want to stick to it because I'll be writing and I'll be like, oh, wow, this is really cool. Let's do this here instead of that. And, so sometimes that can cause some continuity issues. If you're not devoted to your outline. So, that part never really worked for me.
Yeah, that's good advice. Earlier you talked a little bit about how collecting versus, a flipper or a buyer and stuff like that. You are part of a show on Netflix called Swap Shop, right?
Yep, I am.
Let's talk a little bit about that, man, because listen, this is one of those shows that I love. Like it's like Storage Wars and Pickers Made a Baby.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah. And throw a little bit of The Amazing Race and Comic Book Ben in there.
There you go.
we had fun. Season two, by the way, starts next week on Netflix. So you'll be able to check it out there. And we're in negotiations for a possible season three, which is really cool. It was something we had an opportunity to do. The producers were initially pitching the show to History Channel. So they had kind of an American Pickers demo in mind. They were, you know, older white guys, you know, people who watch History Channel. History, for whatever reason, passed on the show. But Netflix wanted it. And, Netflix caters to a younger demo, a more diverse demo. And so they were looking around East Tennessee. They decided they want to do comic books. They wanted kind of a young, innovative, hip store. And so they called us up and asked us if we wanted to audition for it. And we were like, sure. And it was COVID, so everything was done essentially like Zoom. We came in, we taped, and they told us, you know, it's going to be a couple of weeks before they get back to you, whether they like you or not. And I swear, I left my store. I had not walked from my front door to my car before my phone was blowing up. It was the producer saying, they love you. Can you come back and do a second screen test tomorrow? And so we did. And they hired us right there on the spot to do it. So it was this really cool experience that we got to do, man. What I loved about the show, and I think this comes across when you watch it, everything's real. Like every place that we went, there was nothing set up. They didn't plant books. you know, some, we went to several places where we didn't find anything. And then, you know, the ones that we did, we're seeing it for the first time. We're finding it right there on camera. And everything that we bought everything we didn't buy, you know, it was a real negotiation, a real deal with these people. And that was cool. And that was, I mean, there's a little bit of a reality element to it, like the little cutaways, you know, the producers will tell you that, you know, Chris and Abby were our field producers, and they would, you know, they say, okay, so when you were looking and talking to this guy, you said this, I need you to repeat that line during the cutaway. So there's that element of it. There's a little bit of a scripted element to it. But as far as the buying and the picking, that's totally real. That's all us. And I brought all of that stuff back to my store and sold all of it.
That's awesome. No, I completely understand the whole aspect of, you know, hey, say this line again. Sometimes I wish I can go back and be like, hey, let's take it back. Mm-hmm. Can you say it that way? Because when you're editing and cutting things together, it helps a whole lot if you can get them to say it the same way, same kind of energy, and then go mm-hmm. back with it. So you can overlap and all these different technical things that people don't know about when you guys are listening to this at the end user.
Yep. Right. Yeah, that's exactly how it goes, you know?
Right.
And it was great. It was a really, really great experience. We worked with an amazing crew, and the rest of the cast members, the ones we got to work with, they were so funny. And it really shows. It's a good show. And I'm not a reality TV guy. I don't watch that stuff very. I'm more of a documentary type dude. You know, so, but I really enjoy watching Swap Shop. It's fun. And the episodes I don't watch the episodes I'm in, because that's just weird. But I watch all the other episodes and they're fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I always wonder about that. Cause my wife says, why are you doing, like, I'll go back and I'll like go watch and make sure that everything's good on my streams. And I'm like, I'm not watching myself. I'm just making sure that everything's good.
Yeah. You're making sure everything went well.
Everything went well. And because we got people who are on there that want to be there for a reason. So I got to make sure they're good. So, all right, man. Well, I appreciate hanging out with me right here on the House of Indie. Can you please let everybody know where they can find you and when they can find these books, all that good stuff, man?
Yeah, man. So the books, go to your local comic book store. Cult of Dracula, you'll probably have to scoop it up in trade paperback. The single issues are sold out everywhere. Speculators really hopped on it because I do have a television show in development for Cult of Dracula through Sure Pictures. So spec is pretty hot on it. But the trade paperback, go to your local comic book store first. I cannot encourage you enough to support your local comic book store, because those LCSs, they are the backbone of this industry. And I can 100% tell you, I would not be here if I didn't have the support of some incredible retailers who were in on this and believed in me when they had absolutely no reason to. And if we didn't have local comic book shops, everything would be dominated by two big publishers, and everything would be packaged and boring and feature a bat dude or a spider guy. that would be the comic book industry. So your local comic book shop, please support them. Buy it there first. If you can't find it there, go to another retailer. Go to Target, go to Barnes & Noble, whatever, Amazon. And then Rise of Dracula, issues 1 and 2 are out. 2 came out this week. You can find it in comic book stores all over the world. It's sales of Rise of Dracula have exceeded Cult in a lot of ways. So,
wow.
So yeah, it's a really good book. It's getting very strong critical reviews, and there's some good heat on it, especially now that number 2 is out. Because I originally intended what became issues 1 and 2. I wanted them to be one sized issue, and just because of COVID happening and the supply chain problems, the cost of paper was just too expensive to do a jumbo. So we broke it up into 2 parts, and it works that way. I do love it, but I think it reads better if you have issue 1 and 2 kind of read straight through. So Rise of Dracula is in stores now. Cult, if you can find them, scoop them up. If not, pick up the trade paperback.
Awesome. Fantastic. Again, I appreciate you hanging out with me right here on the House of Indie, an exclusive to the Geek Collective. We'll see you guys next time.